Access number 27741, reel 4.
So, this is reel 4, Michael LePage.
March 1944. At the end of the deck landing training on the Clyde, we were divided up between those going straight to frontline squadrons, the 800s in the case of the Fleet Air Arm, and those who for whom there was no gap just at that moment and had to do a week or two's marking time, which I did in the Orkneys. I was really glad of it, the experience, because it was a different life altogether. We could go out in the evenings and buy eggs from the farm, whereas we were in England, we were getting about one egg a week. You could go and buy a dozen eggs, just like that. So the food was good. I was flying martinets, swordfish, and a skua, on one occasion. All these aircraft went out with the Ark. I mean, don't remember much about the martinet. It must have been a bit like the master, I think. The skua, I remember, like the rock, behaved like a rock. The stick was so hard to move that I didn't enjoy that very much. Very, very heavy. But the swordfish was a different matter altogether. And I didn't do very many trips, but it was enough to say I've flown a swordfish string bag with all the wires whistling in the biplane and held together. They used to say it was held together by chewing gum and string because it looked such an improbable aircraft. And, of course, it was. But it beautiful to fly because it was so light and so easy on the controls. The only big thing against it was it's very slow and very vulnerable, therefore, and is chiefly remembered for its attack on the Scharnhorst. And imagine now when most of them were shot down in the channel. But I had just a bit of local flying training and ferrying people, ferrying somebody from Castletown to Hatstone. Hatstone was just outside Kirkwall. And it was a lovely aircraft to fly. It was so easy, and it was an open cockpit, of course. And even in April, it wasn't too bad. The high winds sometimes. I remember the airport, the strips at Twat was a bit small, and they'd extended the runway by about 100 yards or something, each end. And one time the wind was so strong that I came in and did a precautionary landing, as it were, and landed on the extension to the runway and turned off before I even got to the runway. Well, that was a swordfish flying speed of about 35 knots or 40 knots. It would still fly.
Into a 35-knot headwind.
Into a 35-knot headwind. Yes, you're almost standing before you got down. Yes.
And the other, the skua and the martinet, you said that these were planes that... You don't really remember.
I don't remember the martinet at all. It had, I was carrying a midshipman Phillips on a couple of occasions, and LABB, Army AACE, whatever that is, assisted, I don't know, something to do with the Army recce, martinet. Midshipman Phillips seems to have been a local navigation, I suppose he was doing fighter direction exercise. Yes, there we are.
And you were towing drogues for target practice too?
Yes, I took up leading airman Reese on air-to-air on occasion, and Northern Range. It was all gunnery practice, I think, for the Navy in the scupper flow.
So this would be ground guns firing up at your drogue?
Yeah.
And what was that like as an experience?
It was scary. You just hope to get their aim right.
And what were they firing? AK-AK shells?
Oh, something quite small, I think. Yeah, it's just enough to make a hole in the drogue and see if they got it right.
So they wouldn't. These wouldn't be exploding? These wouldn't be?
No. Just a bullet. In fact, I read in the book this morning that they were doing this practice with several aircraft. They were strapped for time. They had to do it quickly. So they coated the bullets with dye, different coloured dye, And so they had about three or four pilots going in one after the other, and when the drogue came down, they just counted the ones with the right die and tallied, made their tally that way.
These would this be tracer? I mean, would you be able to see this stuff?
I don't think so, no. Because I remember quite clear the first time I came across tracer was, I don't know, it might have been. I probably wouldn't have seen much of it because it's behind you. You see, the drogue is quite a long way behind the aircraft, thankfully.
Right, yeah, and you're sitting in the cockpit crossing yourself, I should think. So you come now to the end of the time at Twatt.
Yep.
And you had a personal...
I had a posting. First of all, my brother was getting married in April that year because he had embarkation leave and was off to where he didn't know where. It turned out to be Burma via Nigeria. But he wanted to get married before he went, understandably, and asked me if I'd be his best man. I went to the CO and said, look, my brother's getting married in Birmingham. Oh, he said, well, take an aircraft. You can fly down and come back after it's over. So I was all getting ready to do this, and then suddenly I was posted to Northern Ireland, to a 807 squadron. So I gave up the idea of going to the wedding. Got to Northern Ireland, still in time for the wedding. I went to the CEO again. I said, my brother's getting married. Could I, he said, take an aircraft, take a Seafire and go. This was during wartime, you know. But the next day, almost, all leave cancelled because it was just before the opening beachhead in Normandy. So I never got to his wedding, sadly. But we carried on. I was then posted to join the squadron at Longkesh, Northern Ireland, which is one of the Fleet Air Arm bases, that with Londonderry, Eglinton, and ships coming up and down the Clyde. It meant we could fly on and off when they were out of Greenock, where they were being reconditioned. So we had several weeks. I forget how long it was. Here we are. May, we sailed for Gibraltar. had a nice few weeks at Longkesh, meeting local people, doing practice dive bombing on the Strangford Loch, I think it was, photography, pinpoints, oblique, line overlap. I've got in my logbook here.
But you're reading the logbook. Can you explain? Because a lot of those terms mean nothing to me. dive bombing. What was that?
I've got no details except dive bombing. Again, we had a target in the Strangford Lock, and we carried little 10-pound bombs underneath, and had to do a rather like a skewer. But of course, we didn't have the facility of the skewer to come out of the. Bomb out of the vertical, almost vertical. We just did
skewer.
A...
Sorry, do you mean skewer? Do you mean
no, stuka? What I mean, stuka, sorry. Yep. yes. But ours was quite a steep dive, and we got the target in our sights and dropped the bomb at the last minute and came out.
And which sights were these? Well, these were not the gun sights, surely.
I don't know. I don't think they probably would be, yes. And because you had to allow for the fall, the drop in the, when they released the bomb, it wouldn't go straight ahead, it would drop. I can't remember the detail, I'm afraid, but anyway, we had to practice this getting near the...
And was there a rule of thumb about pulling out when you decided you were close enough?
Yes, you had to not leave it too late.
But how did they train you to do that? Because that must be the most crucial thing, surely.
Well, I think that we had probably had an operational height at which you should release. You know, I'm guessing a bit now.
And what about the other drills that you did there?
Well, photography, pinpoints. We did some oblique line overlap, which is you have to overlap to get. But you don't do very much because the camera is fixed in the aircraft, and all you do is to line up and press the thing in front of you. Press the.
But obliques mean what? Overlapping, so that the picture.
Oblique would mean not overhead, not side.
You were talking about the angle of the camera.
Yeah, the camera, yes, I think so. Mm.
And that would be to get what? More ground detail?
Yes, you're going to get a wider piece of landscape. But I'm just reading, for the sake of my logbook, and I can't remember too much detail.
What was it like joining an opera for the first time, joining an operational squadron then?
Well, a bit daunting. The CO, Lieutenant Commander Baldwin, George Baldwin, great character, commanding 807 Squadron. He was much respected by the squadron. I began to get to know a whole new set of people because you were going to live with them now. There were only about 20 in the squadron, pilots that is. When we got on board HMS Hunter, one of the escort carriers, of course there was all the backup, I mean the ship's company, about 800, and the squadron, 801 squadron on each of these small carriers, probably had about 200 personnel, engineers, mechanics, who maintained the aircraft and looked after in the hangar.
I'm trying to think of, you as a sort of greenhorn, I suppose, arrived with this. How were you received?
There's so many others like me. I mean, we were all young and carefree in those days. You just
was this a brand new squadron, or it had been?
Oh, no. 807, quite one of the, it's been going several, before the war. Mm. But, I mean, constantly changing. I mean, they had different different aircraft. They hadn't had seafires for very long, but so we did deck landings, Hunter to North Front, of course, was Gibraltar. That was our first stop. We had two weeks at sea after leaving Clyde. After these couple of weeks at Long Kesh, we then flew on to the carrier in the Clyde as she was steaming down, landed on deck, and steamed out in a convoy escort. Quite a large number of ships heading for Malta, I expect. But
This was
May 44.
May 44, just before D-Day.
Yes. And when the convoys were beginning to get through to Malta, they'd had a terrible time in 42, 43. But so it took us 2 weeks to get to Gibraltar because we steamed right out into the Atlantic to avoid submarine activity from Brest and the west coast of France. So we got to Gib May the 24th, Hunter to North Front.
And what was it like now living on ship for the first time?
Very noisy. This is the first thing I remember was the air conditioning system was going the whole time. I think there were six of us in a cabin, six of us sub-lieutenants.
What was the name of the ship?
Hunter, HMS Hunter.
Yeah. And she was a small carrier.
She was one of the escort carriers on leased land from America. Had been laid down as a merchant ship and then had been quickly converted to with a flat top put on dock. Deck and accommodation adjusted.
With lifts for the aircraft?
Yeah, two lifts, one fore and one aft. And big hangars, of course, underneath, and fuel tanks under that. So, but they're only about, 400 feet of deck, or am I thinking of, am I wrong? I don't know, about 100 yards, I think. Wasn't very long.
And a little
island. Island on the starboard side, yes.
Ugly looking ship, probably.
Yeah, well, not very pretty, but they're very conspicuous. They became prime targets for the enemy because the Admiralty, dare I say it, were a bit slow to recognize the value of aircraft, of naval aircraft, especially the gunners on the battleships and others. I can remember one gunner, even up in 1945, was heard to say, when the Japanese kamikaze were coming and flying all around, let's get these aircraft out of the sky and let the Navy get on with the job. But what he didn't realize, you see, that you've got a gunner with maybe 30 years of experience. He may be able to hit an enemy ship at 20 miles, about one in 500-600 shots. You've got a little snotty-nosed, snub-nosed sub-lieutenant who's only been training for about a year, like me, but he had the possibility of hitting a ship perhaps out of 1 in 30 attacks, and at a range of anything up to 200 miles. I mean, the odds of and the capability of aircraft over the sea was vastly outmaneuvered, and it took a long time for the Admiralty to realize that the carrier was the in thing.
Even as, I mean, now we're well into the war, and there have been...
Oh, this is, yes, 44, you see.
Right. Mm. So, going back, so you're on the ship, six sub-lieutenants in a sort of fairly pokey little cabin.
Yes.
And this is really your first experience of living on a ship, isn't it? This is after 2 years of training. And
yes.
What was it like?
Well, very close quarters. The wardroom was small. I mean, everything is small, but it was very well, and there was a bar, of course, and some people made more use of it than others.
What about alcohol and flying?
Oh, well.
They don't go together very well.
No, we were strictly forbidden for 24 hours before flying. But when you come down, you tend to indulge the other way. Gin was tuppence a tot, I think, and whiskey was fourpence, and that sort of style. And cigarettes were sixpence for a packet of 20. It was all duty-free, you see. So the temptations were there. But, yes, and of course there was a strain on, when we got into operations, there was a certain strain on coming back into landing on was always a twitchy business. But when we got to Gibraltar, because the squadron flew off the ship, because the ship came into harbour where no flying can take place, and we flew to the airstrip there called North Front and operated from there to keep our hands in while we were waiting for the next move in on the chessboard.
I just wanted to get a bit more of a picture of shipboard life. I mean, what was it like mixing with the other ranks?
Very little, unfortunately. I would have liked to have had more because the domestics were quite separate. And unless you were... The chaplain, if there was one, had a free pass to go anywhere in the ship, of course. And that's why in the Navy, the chaplains don't have a rank. And they just wear a naval jacket and can go anywhere in the ship. My godfather was a chaplain and he used to go down and into the mess decks. But I'm afraid we couldn't really do that very much. We used to meet in the hangar, the fitters and the engineers aren't working on the aircraft.
But I don't understand the system of the past. You actually, even if you were an officer, you couldn't go down into the stoker's mess or...
Well, I suppose you could if you had a special reason to do it. But if you weren't, if you didn't have the capacity, the authority to do something on the mess deck. I mean, I was education officer for the squadron for a short time, but even that didn't. We used to meet in the in sort of neutral ground somewhere. I seem to remember. So I never actually got to the mess deck. I got into the engine room once with one of the engineer officers. But otherwise, no, we just lived our lives. We were fairly fully occupied when we were on the ship, because we were usually working up for an operation. In this case, it was in the southern invasion of southern France. But there was quite a lot of waiting in between, you know, and keeping our hand in and flying.
When you the journey down from the Clyde to Gibraltar, that was, again, did you fly during that time at all?
No. Well, we were on standby. But it would have meant that either we'd have been out of step with the convoy. There were about 30 or 40 ships in the convoy. But to fly off, we would have had to turn into wind, you see, and then that might have been, it wasn't a very fast convoy, speed of the slowest ship, as the old saying goes, which was about 10 knots, I think, or even less.
And were U-boats still a menace then?
Not so much by 44. They were beginning to, Navy and the Air Force beginning to get the upper hand. Especially the Catalinas were able to do much more because of long range, they could spot the U-boats if they came anywhere near the surface.
So you steam into Gibraltar, you fly off, and then you say you keep your hand in. What's going on then?
Well, we stayed. We were quartered at the RAF centre at North Front, which is just underneath the great vertical face of the rock at Gibraltar, facing Spain, and the airstrip goes at right angles to the line of the bit of land joining Gibraltar with Spain, and it builds right out into the harbour. It's the only way you can get any safe approach and takeoff. My main memory of that time was, we used to drive around in a borrowed jeep and through Gibraltar, go under the rock with a tunnel which went right underneath the rock.
Sorry, I'm getting some extraneous noise. Can I?
There was a tunnel which went right under the rock from the dockyard. You had to be able to get into the dockyard, which was not, had to be in the services. And then we used to walk right underneath the tunnel to a beach on the east side in the Mediterranean, where the water was warmer. That was one thing. But another thing, I remember coming into land. Now, on the sea fire, another hazard was if you operated the undercarriage too quickly, the wheels would drop out a little way and then get stuck. They wouldn't go any further down. And the only remedy was to get them back into their seating in the aircraft. This meant turning upside down, flying upside down, pushing the stick well forward so that you get reverse gravity, and the undercarriage would then slot back into its place, which I had to do. And all the toffee papers and toffee papers and dust and bits came out of the bottom of the cockpit into my face. I remember horrid feeling, but anyway, it worked, and I was able to roll back again and make a safe landing.
This was the first time this had happened to you?
Yes, I mean, fortunately, we'd been drilled on this thing, you know. It was the only time. I didn't have to do it again, fortunately.
And it's because you put the undercarriage down too quickly?
Yes, to select the undercarriage down, you had to push the lever forward a bit and wait for a couple of seconds, I think, before you brought it across and pulled it right back. And I must have put it back too quickly, I suppose. And fortunately, there was no action involved. I mean, I was just doing an ordinary flight. I don't know which one it was. I got down here on the North Front to local flying, so it was all right.
And this would have been a hydraulic system?
Yes, it's something to do with the hydraulics. I don't know what the details were, but you had to resort to gravity to get the thing back.
So now you're in Gibraltar. It's beginning of June,
44? Yes, May. We tend to come and go a bit. From there, we went along to Oran, on the North Africa coast, and did a bit work there. La Seigne, Maison Blanche. Where's Maison Blanche? I think.
But I wanted to try and get the experience of your first flight where you saw some
action. Oh, well, that was not until July, August. We were working up there and in Malta. We called in at Malta for a bit. All this was, I don't know quite what we were doing, going backwards and forwards. But
you were shore-based or ship-based?
Well, both. I mean, but at Gibraltar, we were always ashore. But in Malta and Oran, we can't have been there very long. We didn't do any flight. We did a bit of exercising off there. And I remember Yes, we were entertained by the French Foreign Legion. They took us out to their base at Sidi Bel Abbes and were shown all around and doused with quantities of vin rouge and vin blanc until we all flaked out. And they tried to take us around the museum after lunch. Well, that was only fatal. We all flaked out on the cushions. But it was kind of them to show us, because the relationships with the French weren't always very cordial at that stage, especially in North Africa, where there have been one or two incidents.
like?
The bombardment of, we destroyed a couple of battleships, I think, or a couple of ships. My memory is failing me now, but
the Vichy French fleet was sunk.
That's right.
The French were killed. In fact.
Yes.
And there was American, I think, American bombers, American and British bombers.
I think it was mostly British, because when the invasion did take place eventually, it was the Americans who came in first and were told to show the flag very, very forcefully that it was American, not British, because the Entente Cordiale was breaking down at that point, I'm afraid. But anyway, by the time we got there, it wouldn't have been mended, I suppose.
What are your memories of Gibraltar and Malta at that time, then?
Well, Gibraltar was Malta was battered. I mean, the whole place was in ruins. But we did get ashore at Valletta, although we didn't fly anything around there. But we got ashore there and La Seigne.
Did the ship go into the Valletta harbour?
Yes, yes. So we were right inside in the Grand Harbour.
Full of wrecks, because I mean.
Yes, but it was getting back to working state. And on our second visit, we went round to a harbour called Marsa Schlock, which is on the northern coast, I think.
Yep.
Not a very well protected harbour. I remember there was quite a big swell coming in as we were. And we wanted to go ashore. We had to climb down a netting on the side of the ship and wait for the Liberty boat to come up and jump at the right minute. but we did get ashore a bit, and just for a walk. You know. But I don't think we stayed in Malta very long. We seemed to be, I suppose, doing supplies and stores and things, and it was all working up to the invasion of southern France by the Americans, for which we provided air cover, four carriers, and there was four escort carriers.
This was Operation Dragoon.
That's right.
Which was meant, I think, to have taken place at the same time as Overlord, wasn't it?
But well,
there weren't enough landing craft, I seem to remember.
Was that it? I don't remember that part of it, but I've got a beach cover. Here we are. Beach cover, Saint-Tropez. Force cover, tactical reconnaissance, Montpellier, Narbonne. Force cover. So we were doing, I remember doing one strafing on a motor transport, a German truck, because the Germans were then retreating rather quickly from...
We're jumping ahead of a bit of ourselves here, aren't we, now, because the Dragoon hasn't started. I wanted, you've got the build-up. You know that something's going to happen. Do you know what it is?
No, we didn't know anything at all.
You didn't work out that it would be an attack?
No, I don't think so. It was all very tight security, tight secrecy.
So when were you informed? So
we'd have a briefing in the flight... in the preparation of flight, the aviator's preparation, what was he called? I don't know. Anyway, we'd be briefed with maps and by the CO, excuse me, and he would then tell us what was going on, what we were to do.
Right, so we're at the beginning of Dragoon, you're being briefed.
We were now flying CFIRE L2Cs, which were an advance on the CFIRE L1. And we're preparing for this cover of the invasion of southern France near Saint-Tropez. So we were doing beach cover. This is where I saw Tracer for the first time, I think, or Action, really, for the first time.
How did that feel? And were you now happy with the deck landings? You've got used to it?
Not entirely, no. But I was coping all right. I'd done, total deck landings, 36. Total flying, 254 hours on as pilot and 108 as dual. This was August 1944.
So this is just over 2 years since you started.
But only just over a year flying. I mean.
Yeah. Mm. So then you have the briefing and you're told what it's about. How detailed was the briefing?
Well, each sortie was different. I mean, it could be beach cover, which would mean just going in and observing, dealing with any enemy aircraft that might come. It could be dropping a bomb, 500-pound bomb I had one time.
So were you told about the overall global?
No, just the very local situation. I don't think we knew what was going on. I've been reading lately Churchill's book of the war, and noticed how he didn't want this operation at all. The Americans wanted to do it, the sort of soft underbelly of Hitler's Europe, but it meant that Churchill had to withdraw some of the brigades from Italy, where he was hoping to have made a quick dash to get to Berlin before the Russians, which would have made a big difference to the division of Europe after the war. Americans weren't interested in dividing out Europe or Russia so much, and they wanted this show to go ahead, and Churchill had to give in. So we didn't know anything about this at the time. We just thought it was a nice, fun show, you know. Wasn't so much fun. I was with flying. We always flew in pairs. I was with a chap called Lloyd. We used to call him Doc Lloyd. He wasn't a doctor, but we were told to investigate a little ship which was suspected of being an enemy ship. Enemy, quite a small thing. And as the CO gave us the instruction where to go, as we dived down, suddenly this tracer started coming up at us. Still don't know what sort of ship it could have been there, whether it could have been German, I don't think. Anyway, this is another disadvantage of the Seafire inline engine. Being liquid cooled, there are a lot of little pipes which carry the coolant system all around.